Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Yes, we're going back to school. Parents and teachers are getting ready to jump back into the classroom with their children. Let's talk about the issues relating to all of the various issues in education law. With us to discuss these issues is attorney Marina D'Ambri. She is a partner of D'Ambri and Vaccari, whose practice focuses on education and school law, emphasis on representing students and parents. She deals with issues of discipline, suspension, bullying investigations, IEPs, post-secondary education disputes, as well as DCFS and child welfare matters. Marina, thank you so much for joining me again.
Thanks for having me on.
And as we get ready for back to school, we have a new cell phone ban in Illinois that's taking effect. Can you tell our listeners what this law provides?
Yeah, of course. The new law requires that public schools adopt policies restricting student cell phone usage during the school day. But this isn't going to take place until 27-28 school year. And there are important exceptions to this that I think are noteworthy. These include that when a phone might be needed for medical reasons, an IEP or 504 call for it, certain educational purposes or emergencies, and schools also have flexibility, so particularly at the high school level. And the goal here is really to reduce distractions without preventing students from having access to technology where there's a legitimate need.
And do you think, just from what you've seen, I know that other states have had these types of bans, and they've proven, I think, that the students do better, and they are more focused on their schoolwork rather than on whatever they're doing on their devices.
Yeah, I think it's great. Cell phones, have been a significant distraction to all of us, especially our students in schools. So not only academically throughout the day, but also socially, and having a statewide baseline takes some of that battle away from the individual teachers and districts. But what I particularly like is that the law isn't absolute, which means it protects students who legitimately need their devices, like I said, for medical reasons, IEPs, or other specific needs. It also can prevent schools from being overly harsh with discipline related to cell phones. So I think that it is going to be very beneficial.
And that brings me kind of to my next topic, which is bullying and cyberbullying. I see statistics that are astounding. 20% of American students ages 12 to 18 were bullied on school property. About 16% ages 12 to 18 were cyberbullied. A new law went into effect expanding the definition of cyberbullying. First of all, Marina, tell me, is it, you deal with these issues all the time with parents and teachers, students. Is this really the epidemic that we are being told it is?
So technology is becoming very prevalent, and I would say is almost taking over as far as the leading cause of bullying. Our world is changing, and we need our laws to change with it. So I would say as far as for cyberbullying, we have some great laws coming to effect that protect our students for this. So as you know, AI is getting so advanced that it can even make fake images of classmates, and students can distribute this in seconds. So although these images may be fake, the harm is very real. The law that is coming up here that we've talked about will make it clear that this type of conduct can constitute cyberbullying and requires the school to take it seriously. So it kind of fills in the gray area that schools are struggling here with as far as technology advancing.
And when it comes to cyberbullying, I mean, it still has to be harassing, right? So if a student creates a fake picture of a classmate and then just says, happy birthday, Sally, or something, that's not going to be cyberbullying necessarily, right?
No. So the bullying needs to be, severe and pervasive enough to disrupt the school environment. So having very real effects when it comes to education or extracurricular activities. So that doesn't sound like something that would do that.
No. And so when, let's just say your child is being bullied, whether it's a schoolyard bullying or cyberbullying, what do you recommend that the parents do to take action?
Well, first of all, I would recommend that you document everything. save any screenshots, any messages, and start keeping your own timeline of what happened. Next, I'm going to recommend that you report it to the school in writing, and you're going to specifically ask that it be investigated under the district's bullying policy in Illinois law. And the law states that each district actually needs to have their own published bullying policy. So don't just ask what will happen to the other student. I would ask, what are you going to do, you being the district, to make sure my child feels safe coming to school tomorrow? And if the district doesn't adequately respond, escalate your concerns to the administration. And the key for parents is to document, report in writing, and continue following up until there's a meaningful plan to keep their child safe.
Do you ever recommend to deal with the parent of the student who's offending directly?
No, I always would recommend going to the school.
Okay. And do you see, I mean, I think years ago when I had friends who have children in grade school, it was really not handled very well in my view, that sometimes they would actually recommend that the bullied child go to another school and leave the bully, you know, the bullying student at the school. I think, have things progressed and have things gotten better when it comes to awareness and how these cases are handled?
I think it has. I think that now since we have our bullying law in place, there needs to be bullying investigations. If there's a determination, you know, that there's enough, doesn't even have to be enough evidence, it could just be concern. So there's investigation, your child would be interviewed or have the opportunity, and same with the other student who's being accused. And then they would come up if they did find that there was bullying with something called a safety plan to make sure that your child feels like they can continue on in the educational environment.
I think, Marina, you know, you deal with these issues all the time, but I think some of my, maybe my older listeners would say and have said to me, you know, listen, when we were kids, we got bullied, and, you know, you just, it makes kids tough, and, you know, you need to teach your child to have the water off the duck's back. What, when, is there some idea that that's a good way to think about it? Or are we just in a different world now where children are different and the nature of bullying is different?
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, since technology is ever so evolving so quickly here, I think it's a really tough question to answer now, what is considered bullying and what's not. But, you know, I would agree to some point that bullying is sometimes used too broadly. But in that sense, not every disagreement, not every argument or unkind interaction between a child is legally considered bullying. And I want to emphasize legally here. Schools have to keep in mind, you know, that kids are going to have conflicts with each other. They're going to have disagreements. They're going to hurt each other's feelings and make mistakes. So under Illinois law, bullying generally involves conduct, like I said, that was severe and pervasive enough to cause certain significant harms, such as substantially interfering with the child's education or creating a reasonable fear of harm. So the distinction matters because we want schools to take true bullying seriously while still allowing children to learn how to navigate ordinary conflict, like you said, and resolve disagreements and develop resilience.
Absolutely.
So it's a little bit of both.
Yeah, yeah. And that it's not a definite line, probably, you know. And it can be subjective, too. I would imagine, too, that there are some students who are just naturally more sensitive to those types of things and others who can walk away from it and be okay.
Exactly.
Marina D'Ambri is with the law firm of D'Ambri and Vicari. How can people reach you? I'm going to put you on hold. We're going to take a break, but I want to give out your contact information.
Yeah, of course. They can reach us at our website, dblaw.us. And you, from there on, go ahead and search for my name there, and you can email me or call me.
We are here with Maria D'Ambri. She is the founder of D'Ambri and Vicari. They concentrate their practice in all things special education, school discipline, suspension, even DCFS and child welfare guardianship matters. Thank you so much for taking time to join us. I had a texter, Marina, I want to just cover this briefly, who was asking about dress codes and how some schools have banned certain kinds of short skirts and yoga pants and things like that. When does a dress code become something that is actionable or discriminatory, and are you seeing more of these codes?
Yeah, you know, as far as in the public school setting, I haven't seen too many changes, but to that I would say, of course, you know, We all have our First Amendment rights that we are entitled to, and we are entitled to those in the school and educational environment as well. So that includes freedom of speech, freedom of religion, et cetera. But where schools are able to take action when it comes to this is also where it would be a substantial disruption to the school environment. So once again, I'm sorry, there's some gray area in there. It's kind of like a case-by-case basis, but I would say that is what it would they would be able to get, you know, and codes for.
And yeah, I mean, what's disruptive? But, you know, let's just pivot to private schools. That's a whole different thing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, private schools can have more restrictive, I mean, they can tell you to wear a uniform, as a matter of fact.
Exactly. That's what they can do. Since they're private, you know, you don't have to go there. And also public schools, we all have the right to a free and appropriate public education. But private schools can really kind of do what they want as well, as long as it's within federal laws.
Let's talk about IEPs. And I just want to assume that nobody knows what that is. Mm-hmm. Your child has a special need. What is an IEP?
Yeah, so that's an individualized educational program, and it is legally enforceable for a student with a disability who needs special education.
So
it outlines, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Marina.
Oh, yeah. It outlines, you know, the student has individual goals for a disability, services they might need, accommodations and support. And the purpose for an IEP is to ensure that the child receives, like I said, the free and appropriate public education that is designed around their unique needs.
And I assume that you sometimes have parents who think their child is entitled to one and the school doesn't think so. And I'm sure you also have parents who have an IEP for their student, but the school is not properly accommodating them. Are those the kind of two places where you get involved as a lawyer?
Exactly. And that's where we can help anybody who needs assistance.
And so, like, can you give maybe an example of a student who may have a special need and the school is just not getting around to accommodating that need?
Yeah, you know, some children might require assistive technology, like that goes back to the cell phone ban too that we can talk about. And sometimes that assistive technology is available on an iPad, or it can be available even on a phone. And so let's say that maybe that child doesn't have access to an iPad or a phone throughout the school day. We can help, you know, grant that access. Or more importantly, too, there's, you know, placements. If a school cannot meet your child's needs, there are alternative educational placements that are available for them to receive that free and appropriate public education. So it's kind of a small example of what, you know, we can help with.
And, you know, before you hire a lawyer, what would you be your advice to a parent who maybe is navigating this and is not getting what they think, you know, the school should be doing? Before calling Marina D'Ambri, what should they be doing to try to do this themselves first?
Yeah, first of all, I think, you know, we want to acknowledge that it's a very intimidating aspect to have. This is your child's education, so we want to make sure we're doing right by your child. But my biggest piece of advice that I would tell parents is to put any concerns that they have in writing, document everything, and ask questions. No question is a bad question. Parents are an equal member of an IEP team, and they should not be afraid to speak up when something isn't working or if they just don't understand anything. And if your child continues to struggle despite the supports being provided, don't wait. You got to request that evaluation or a meeting and address it early.
Let's pivot to school discipline. If a child is accused of misconduct, what rights does the student have before suspensions or expulsions happen?
Yeah. So, of course, you know, students have the right to due process within their public school setting. And even when accused of serious misconduct, that is still there. Generally, they have the right to know what they're being accused of, hear the basis for the accusation, and have an opportunity to tell their side of the story. For an expulsion and a long-term suspension, there are additional protections, which can include the right and should include the right to a hearing.
And I don't know if you're familiar with this, but you probably are. Wasn't there a law passed just recently that would prohibit schools from expelling students in certain situations?
So there are laws that protect students who have disabilities when the action that is going to be disciplined is a manifestation of their disability.
So what would be an example of that?
So an example of that would say, maybe the most relatable to people is if a student has Tourette's and maybe the student yells something out in class that is either offensive or, potentially a threat that can't be mitigated, then we need to understand, okay, this is a manifestation or a circumstance of their disability. So it's kind of one of the more relatable ones that I can give here.
Sure. Let's talk about the right to privacy. I mean, students, you don't check your constitutional rights at the door when you're a student, but I would imagine that schools have a few more rights than because of the age of the and the nature of the caretaking that a school really takes on. But like, can they search a student's backpack, a locker, a cell phone? At what point can they actually do that without a warrant?
Yeah, so this is totally acceptable in many cases, but there are limits. So schools generally need reasonable grounds to believe that the search will uncover evidence that the student violated a law or a school rule, and the search must be reasonable in scope. So a cell phone raises greater privacy concerns. Having the phone does not automatically give the school unlimited authority to search everything on it, but like I said, there must be reasonable grounds to do so.
Again, pivoting to artificial intelligence, and again, as you noted, the laws sometimes are struggling to keep up with the technology that's going on. There is a huge concern that AI is being used in the classroom by students to write papers, to do things, and to basically get around the idea of learning by using AI. Are there laws in place on this? Are there school rules in place on this? And what would you advise parents to do and to advise their children on the use of AI?
So there definitely can be school rules. As far as laws right now, there's nothing that I've heard of. But I just want to preface this, too, by telling kids that AI is not always correct. If you use it, which I don't recommend, I would double check everything. If you use it to write a paper and submit it as your own work, you could be violating your school's academic integrity policy and face discipline. Beyond the disciplinary consequences, you're also missing the opportunity to develop the writing, the critical thinking, and the problem-solving skills the assignment was designed to teach you. So overall, I would say stay away from it.
And homeschooling. I know that it's really increased in the last maybe 10 years, and Illinois has maybe between 170 and 210 children who are homeschooled. That's quite a few. What are the rules about homeschooling, and are there any significant rules?
Yeah, so Illinois has historically treated homeschooling as a form of private education. So with significant deference to the parents' rights to direct their children's education. So as a result, Illinois has relatively little oversight. There's generally no registration, no standardized testing, or state-approved curriculum requirements, but the parents still have an obligation to provide instruction in required subjects. Those subjects are typically language arts, math, biology, physical sciences, social sciences, fine arts, PE, and health. So they do have to follow those, and I think that it's very important that if a parent does decide that they want to homeschool, that they check with ISB regarding these topics.
And you've seen a lot of homeschooling parents, and the kids go to college. Is there some words of advice to the parents on what to do to make sure your homeschooling is going to be able to open up the kids to good colleges without the grade point average that you're going to see in a high school?
Yeah, so for college, homeschooling itself is generally not a barrier, but students should maintain a solid transcript and documentation showing the courses that they did complete. And if they do any standardized testing, show that as well. So that's what I would recommend if they are going from a homeschooled high school setting to college.
So you're going to be busy this time of year, and next time I want to talk a little bit about DCFS investigations, because I know of all the things you do, you handle those too, and I think a lot of people have questions about that, but we just don't have time. Marina D'Ambri, thank you so much for joining us. She is with the law firm of D'Ambri and Vicari, and can you tell everyone how to get to your website, how to get to maybe your email and your phone number?
Yeah, of course. So our website is dvlaw.us, DV as in D'Ambri Vicari. Go ahead and hit my profile in my email, as well as my phone number should be there. My phone number is 847-604-0551. Go ahead and reach out to us, and we'd be happy to get in touch with you.